with the rules of the court, you'll each have 15 minutes, 5 minutes of rebuttal for appellant. State your name at the beginning of your argument and who you represent. These matters are being recorded. So with that, attorney for appellant, are you ready to proceed?
I'm adding 3 inches to the board. May it please the court, counsel, my name is Will Flegel, and along with Molly Burke, we represent the appellant in this matter. The appellant was sexually abused by a teacher at a charter school and sued the school for negligent hiring. The school sought a dismissal, claiming its hiring decisions were subject to statutory discretionary immunity. The trial court agreed, ruling that all hiring decisions are policy decisions and that the school need not prove a policy. On appeal, we contend that the school did not fulfill its obligation to prove that its hiring in this case was based on a policy that involved the balancing of social, political, and economic considerations, because there was no evidence of that. And if a policy did exist, the evidence showed that that policy was not followed. In response, the school has asserted that there was no evidence of foreseeability of this teacher's propensities, and our reply brief, I believe, addressed those considerations. So I would like to begin with the issue of whether hiring in general is always a policy decision, unless the court would prefer another topic.
No, I'm curious about your reading of the Fear case.
Thank you, Your Honor. Fear is perhaps the best entree into this subject matter. Fear literally says at page 212 of the decision that hiring and supervision are policy level activities. But I think if we look at the context in Fear, you see that that is expressing the court's view about policy development as opposed to an individual application of policy to a specific hire. This really raises a troubling concern in the event that a school can develop a policy to hire pedophiles. That would be...
Counsel, I wanted to stop you there real quick because you repeatedly refer to pedophile as in particular to, I'm not sure how to pronounce his last name, Armstead. Has he been formally diagnosed with paraphilia or pedophilia?
He's been incarcerated, but Your Honor, the answer to your specific question is no. I was trying to address Judge Riley's question in a broader context as to what type of, you're right, we did do that in the brief. I want to make that clear. But I'm trying to address a broader concern of Judge Riley, which has to do with what kind of policies can be adopted by a municipality that would fall beyond a court's ability to second guess them. And so I'm using an extreme example of a policy where we want to hire pedophiles to interact with the children we supervise.
I just want to make sure that we're using the correct terminology in the correct context.
This teacher had sexual interaction with a student, whatever the proper term for that would be, Your Honor.
Okay, thank you.
So if I may, Judge Riley, back to your consideration here, the reason that I think that Fear is speaking more broadly to the development of a policy as opposed to its implementation is that if we look at Fear itself, in that case, the issue was the hiring and training of all janitors who are removing snow. It wasn't a decision about whether to hire janitor Bob or not. The other cases that each side has wrestled with include the Gleason case, mm-hmm. which is the MTC bus case. And there, it was the issue that was the subject of discussion was the hiring and training of all city bus drivers, whether they should afford respect to the Minnesota Human Rights Act or not, not the decision on whether to hire driver Dan. And in the Park Center case, which I believe is the other one that we've both discussed, There, it was not a hiring decision. Generally, the issue was the discretion that should be afforded to an employer to determine the amount of appropriate discipline, which obviously involves broad policy development type of issues. So I'm viewing it on a different plane, if that addresses.
And so you aren't seeking to have fear overturned, you're just seeking to have it read in the way that you just articulated.
I'm hoping that this court will afford some context to that pronouncement, because it can be read as a very broad holding. No hiring decision can be second-guessed by a court, even if it's so extreme that it would intentionally promote the hiring of dangerous persons to supervise children. So the takeaway that I'm urging this court...
Or even if the school district failed to comply with known statutory obligations. I mean, right, fear could be taken so broadly as to say, even if the school district fails to follow their statutory obligations during hiring, that would still be immune.
Correct. That raises an interesting issue, Judge Larson, and that's, are we talking there about official act immunity, since we're talking about the implementation and at an operational level, having people conform their conduct to a specific policy? Or are we talking about policy-level decision-making where we're dealing with statutory discretionary immunity? Here, the sole basis of the motion is the latter of those, statutory discretionary immunity. There's some overlap here.
Where is the overlap there? Because I do, I think that respondents in their brief sort of point to that you can make a distinction in the law between failing to comply with, for example, the obligation to do a background check and what immunity attaches to that from immunity for hiring level decisions. Do you agree with that distinction as they articulated, or do you see that distinction differently?
There's a rational basis for that distinction, so I would not disagree with it. I disagree about how it applies in our specific case. I think under Thompson that no official would ever have the capacity to deviate from a policy as long as it's a mandatory policy. What we wrestled with in this case was, if you're going to claim immunity based on a policy, please tell us what that policy was and show us that that policy, whatever it was developed weighing social, political, and economic considerations. Because under Conlon versus the City of St. Paul, that's the obligation of every municipality, is to fulfill that obligation. Here, our disconnect with the trial court was that she felt that they were relieved of any burden simply because this was a hiring decision, end of discussion. And that's why understanding the limits of fear and the scope of that rule become very important. But when we get to the operational level, if there's a policy and if it's mandatory, you've got to follow it.
Why isn't the hiring checklist here the policy?
Pardon me, Your Honor?
Sure. Why isn't the hiring checklist the policy here?
Why isn't it the policy?
Correct. Isn't that the policy?
About half the people said that it was, and about half the people said that it wasn't. If it was a policy, Principal Bump said she felt constrained it had to be followed. But we know at an operational level that it wasn't, because most of the checklist is left blank, Your Honor. So if it was
to the extent that it was followed, let me rephrase it. To the extent that it was not followed, that portions of it, isn't it more relevant that the portions that were followed were key? In other words, doing a criminal background check. It seems that, you know, because that was done, because, you know, the main steps that under that checklist were followed, why isn't that sufficient? I mean, if we quibble about, well, references were listed, but there wasn't any follow-up.
Is it a cake if the cake's missing two of its ingredients?
Well, I think the key is whether or not the ingredients that are missing are key ingredients versus ingredients that are not really relevant to the issue here of whether or not they knew or should have known that this person had a history of criminal sexual misconduct. And so I think for that seems to be really the key question here, right?
If the issue is, can a municipality make a policy that, in let's say intentionally, only looks at two or three items, when, as Judge Larson pointed out, the statute may have broader obligations, or it may exist in the context of a broader duty. I think there that if there is a higher policy, say the policy of the state of Minnesota as established through the policymaking organ of the legislature, then any policy by a municipality would have to conform to that. But I want to answer your question in a slightly different way, and that is, since we're talking here about a policy and that statutory discretionary immunity, that's the exception to what? It's the exception to the general rule in 466.02 that all municipalities and their employees are accountable for their torts under the common law, unless immunity is proven to exist. We challenge whether the immunity was proven to exist here. A trial court disagreed with us or said that really they didn't have to prove it. But we default to the general rule that there is common law liability for a negligent hire. And the record here demonstrates the shortcomings of the search that was undertaken.
Well, part of the, and I don't want to put words into respondents' mouths, but part of their argument, I think, is that you have Ms. Bump, who is the principal of the school, but that the school itself had outsourced some of its hiring or some of the pieces of the hiring to Harvest Network of Schools. And they're the ones who, she did what she was supposed to do. They didn't do what they were supposed to do. HNS is not named as a defendant. You lose. How do you respond to that?
In terms of the obligation that one would have in undertaking any hiring or screening procedure, if you set as policy, we're going to farm part of this out, then we should be able, when we're challenging that conduct, to understand what's a part of this entity's obligation, what's a part of that entity's obligation, and there should be evidence that demonstrates that at some level there was a weighing and balancing of the social, political, and economic considerations that make it a policy.
I think they did talk about the economic considerations, that it was
cheaper
for them to outsource a whole lot of the HR, typical HR responsibilities on either side of the actual interview and decision to hire.
So would there be ultimate accountability then with the employer who's farmed part of this out for the negligent act of its employee subordinate? Under respondeat superior, there would. We didn't get there in this case based on the state of the record and when the summary judgment came into play. But in answer to your question, there would be respondeat superior liability on the part of a municipality for its employees. And that would include those to whom it deferred part of the work.
As I understand it, there were two motions for summary judgment. There was an amended complaint that alleged negligent supervision and vicarious liability.
We didn't.
That was dealt with in the first summary judgment. And then there was negligent retention, which you dismissed. And so that leaves us with the negligent hiring.
Yes, this appeal is only about a negligent hire,
okay,
and nothing more, at the way that we've selectively addressed the issues.
Okay.
Because of the absence in meeting its fundamental burden of proof, we don't believe that there could be statutory discretionary immunity and would ask for reversal. Thank you.
You'll have 5 minutes for rebuttal if you choose to use it. Counsel for respondents.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, counsel. My name is Christian Schaefer. I'm here with my associate, Frank Langan, on behalf of Respondents Best Academy and Mastery School. Your Honors, you've already discussed the two issues in the case, foreseeability and the application of statutory immunity. I'd like to start with foreseeability unless you would like to go somewhere else.
Did the district court even rule on foreseeability?
The court ruled on foreseeability throughout both of the summary judgment motions. The court did not make a specific finding in terms of negligent hiring. The court did, however, loop negligent hiring back in under plaintiff's general negligence claim and said it's not foreseeable in that context, which makes sense if you look at Yunker, and I believe it's Watson, where they talk about negligent hiring and negligent retention arising out of the same sort of doctrine.
So there is an explicit decision by the district court on foreseeability with respect to negligent hiring then?
Not with respect to negligent hiring specifically. There are several specific decisions with regard to Hermstead's conduct. That's how I pronounce it, by the way. Not being foreseeable.
Hermstead. Okay, thank you.
Not being foreseeable at any point. The court said it was not foreseeable at the time that Hermstead committed the assault. It was not foreseeable during his tenure in employment. And if that's the case, how could it have been foreseeable at the time he was hired? All the things leading forward, it wasn't foreseeable at the time. That it occurred in 2018 or 17. Record's unclear on that, but not in 2016 when he was hired.
So, let's talk about fear.
Sure.
And Mr. Wiggle's hypothetical that if a school had a policy of saying we will only hire pedophiles under fear, where it says hiring, supervising, training, and retaining municipal employees are policy-level activities that are protected by statutory immunity. Do you read fear to say that?
I do not, Your Honor, and I do not because Section 466.03 Subdivision 6 requires an act of discretion by the government entity. The school has no discretion to do a background check. That's in the 123B03. The school has no discretion to check with MDE to see if there's been any action against the licensure. I don't think, to Judge Larson's question earlier, no school has the ability to deviate from that without exposing itself to liability.
So what are the outer limits of fear?
The outer limits of fear would be hiring. In this case, hiring is a policy-level decision, which the court also said in Gleason, subject to statutory requirements and subject to things that, I guess it's another way of saying what I was going to say. The legislature saying what schools have to do. This is fundamentally a legislative fix, if there is an issue to fix. The legislature has rejected amendments, and this is in our brief, to 123B03 that would require the additional kinds of information that appellant thinks that they could have gotten, the existence of a maltreatment complaint, which the schools could not have gotten under the Data Praxis Act. And if the legislature would like to go there in the future, that will be yet another limit on fear.
Would you agree that fear requires the school to follow its policy?
The question is whether the school had policy. And in this had discretion.
That
Sorry.
Is a good question,
no,
too.
I misspoke, but I understand what you're saying, Your Honor. The school's policy was that HNS would do everything except for the three things that Paula Bump said that she did, except it's articulated in our brief, but it's file the request to hire, identify candidates to interview, and actually conduct the interviews. Paula Bump did those things. HNS didn't do everything in its checklist. The school's policy was to contract with HNS.
Doesn't the fact that HNS did not follow the policy, doesn't that put it outside of fear then?
Well, HNS itself is not a government entity. It was an independent contractor. I believe Mr. Flegel said employee, but it was an independent contractor by its
but
terms.
Under agency law, wouldn't the school still be liable for the actions of HNS?
That requires an employment relationship. I believe the court has said that there is no vicarious liability in absence of an actual employment relationship. HNS certainly could have been sued. It's mentioned in the complaint. Plaintiff was well aware of it. They're not standing here represented by someone else. They were not sued. Your Honor, you asked a question. You got an answer about it being a cake, and I'm sorry, I can't, that's low-hanging. I can't let that go. The cake is doing the background check, contacting MDE, the Board of Teaching, or Pelsby, I believe it's called now, I still call it the Board of Teaching, to ask about discipline status. That's the cake. The background check, the reference check, digging in to do other things, that is at best sprinkles on the cake. I wouldn't even call it frosting. So it is still a cake, Your Honor. It might not be the cake, the type of cake that plaintiff would prefer to have, but it is still the cake, as you said.
Can I ask a question about fear before we get too far away?
Of
Do
course.
You think that the district court read fear too broadly? I mean, when I'm reading the district court's order, I don't know that the district court has, you know, made this nuance that hiring is policy subject to statutory requirements. And I guess I'd be interested in your thoughts about how the statutory requirements interact with immunity itself.
So I'm going to start by saying if the district court did read too broadly, that is harmless error in this case because the statute was followed. But that being said, no, I don't think in this case, on the record we have in this case, that the district court read it too broadly. And fear is the case we're talking about. Gleason also said, so twice this court has said hiring and training and retention, but hiring is what we're focused on, are policy-level decisions without further analysis or further instruction. And I can't say that that's dicta in those cases. They are central to the holding. And there's not a lot of analysis in the court's opinions in that to go on. So I think the district court was right to look at precedent and say, here's a direct quote directly from, you know, the center of the case. And I understand that Gleason also had the Minnesota Human Rights Act charge, and that's where the court spent the majority of its energy on in that case, but there's no statutory charge in this case, or claim rather in this case. So following that directly. You're right, the district court did not analyze specifically in the negligent hiring whether the statutory requirements were followed. The background check is mentioned in the district court's order. I don't remember which order off the top of my head, but the district court was aware that the statutory requirements had been followed. And frankly, had they not been followed, we'd be having a very different conversation.
So you would agree that there are limitations to fear. It's not, despite the fact that it, I think, actually twice says, you know, hiring is a policy and is subject to statutory immunity, that statement alone is not sufficient. There are some exceptions to that rule.
As much as I would love blanket immunity for most of the decisions my clients make, I agree, Your Honor. There are limitations. They're set by the legislature. As I said earlier, this is a legislative fix.
Okay.
They could not deviate, could not say, we're only hiring criminals to work with our children, or we're ignoring this criminal background check and hiring a known criminal. That would be that would be negligent hiring. But that goes to foreseeability in this case, Your Honor, too, if we're ready to discuss that. But
well, I guess I just wanted to make sure that we're being clear about what the scope of fear is. So you would see this as a different case, just as a hypothetical, if your client had not done a background check, that this would be a different case in terms of our analysis under immunity.
I do, Your Honor. 466.03 says that when the government official, and I'm paraphrasing here, has discretion, or the government entity has discretion, it has a policy-level decision. The government entity does not have discretion, or in this case the school board, does not have discretion to deviate from Minnesota Statutes 123B.03, I think it's 03, and conduct the background check. And contact MDE. And again, the legislature was asked, and there were a couple of bills to propose different amendments to get more information in the hands of schools. For whatever reason, the legislature rejected both of those. One of those proposed amendments, was right around the time Hermstead was hired, 2016 or 2015, I believe, and it didn't go through. The legislature is aware of the information that schools receive, a criminal background check and a license check to make sure the teacher still is licensed, doesn't have public discipline or any discipline on his record, and that's it. If they want schools to check to see if there has ever been a maltreatment complaint filed, regardless of the outcome of the maltreatment complaint, the legislature could add that and has shown its willingness to consider that in the past, although it didn't make it past committee.
Counsel, I want to go back to another question that you kind of asked yourself, I think, and it was one I wanted to ask, is what is the policy here?
The policy is to have HNS perform the majority of the hiring functions with the principal completing the three steps I mentioned, selecting candidates to interview, interviewing the candidates and filling out the request to hire form. That is the school's policy. They have outsourced their HR function in that regard, or had outsourced their HR function at that time. If the decision is that we're looking at the specific decision to hire, that is, as the court said in, I believe Yonker, that is the direct implementation of the policy decision. The school followed what HNS said to do to hire him. He passed his criminal background check, let's hire him. And implementing that policy by then hiring after you've completed your portion of those steps, that is directly correlated to implementation of the policy. It's directly related to the policy. It's exactly the type of implementation of policy decision. Yonker said that statutory immunity would be dead letter if there was a bright, clear distinction between the policy, in this case, contracting out HR functions, and the implementation, in this case, hiring the person that your contracted out HR function said to hire. So that's there's no clear line between implementation, as the court has said in Yonker.
And is that how you would respond to appellant's argument that, you know, Fear and Gleason were really about the policy itself, and this case is about one particular individual who was hired? And because I think that appellant is trying to say that we should read Fear and Gleason as looking at, like, actual policy, and that the claim that they've brought has to do with the particular hiring of a particular individual.
Gleason involves a particular claim against a particular bus driver, so I don't read Gleason particularly as broadly or high level as appellant's counsel. The bus driver in Gleason was, you know, belligerent and nasty, discriminatory to a handicapped individual. That's not a question about, like in Fear, about janitors piling snow. This was one person named in the complaint, who engaged in bad acts, and there was a question, was Metropolitan Transportation negligent for hiring that person? Is how I read the court's decision in Gleason. Very quickly, I'm down to about a little under 3 minutes, Your Honor, if I could address foreseeability. I'm just going to be blunt on this one, Your Honors. Aaron Hermstead fooled everyone. At the time he was hired by Mastery in 2016, he had successfully fooled the Brooklyn Center Police Department, the Hennepin County Attorney's Office, Hospitality House, where he was currently working as a volunteer or volunteering, and the Minnesota Department of Education's Maltreatment Division, which included the investigator who did the maltreatment investigation, who was a seasoned former police officer with decades of experience. You have the maltreatment report in front of you, or in the record, rather. You see the steps that the police officer took, the former police officer, the investigator, to look at this. Appellant's standard of foreseeability really asked the court to say that a charter school should have done better than the state, the police department, and prosecutors in finding out that Mr. Hermstead would be a risk of harm to children, particularly, but a risk of harm down the road. And it comes down to their expert affidavits, the well-known hazard doctrine. That has never been a part of any negligence claim. The court looked at well-known hazard as a standard of foreseeability, I'd say recently, but I think it's 2016, which COVID, it feels recent, in the Doe v. Columbia Heights case. It's in the briefing in there. It was argued with respect to the negligence claims as well, and it was rejected. Well-known hazard is purely a creature of a vicarious liability, and the vicarious liability claim was dismissed and not appealed. And the vicarious liability claim was dismissed largely in part because of that Doe v. Columbia Heights case, where well-known hazard does not apply to government entities because of a different provision in Chapter 466, 466.03, Subdivision 16, I believe. So we're looking at, was it foreseeable based on the evidence that, regardless of whether the policy was followed perfectly, regardless of whether H&S could have done a better job, was it foreseeable based on the evidence that could have been gathered that Mr. Hermstead posed a risk of harm, particularly of sexual assault? And the answer is no. At best, Mastery could have discovered that a complaint had been made. That's under the Data Praxis Act, personnel data. They could have seen a complaint, and as alluded to in our brief, a complaint is not the substance of the complaint. If I go to my child's school and say, your teacher wore a shirt I didn't like, that is a complaint. If I say that the subordinate was late to work, that is a complaint. Complaint is everything from that to the complaint that was made against Mr. Hermstad, and the schools had no way of knowing that, Your Honor, at the time. Unless there are other questions, I am out of time and the light's blinking.
Thank you. Any rebuttal?
Yes, please. The two most important things you just heard from my friend, I want to make very clear in your minds. The first is that we've learned what the policy is, and it just took an appeal to do it. The third important element of policy is filling out the request to hire form. Guess what happened here? They didn't fill out the request to hire form, so they deviated from their own policy. The second important thing my friend said is that under 466.03, it covers only those aspects and affords protection only for those aspects where you have the ability to make a discretionary decision. When don't you? When your policy says you must do something. So at a minimum, we've got a genuine fact issue that requires reversal here. The other thing is that if the trial court read fear too broadly, I think you have to reverse and remand to afford the opportunity to address those considerations. And I thought it was Germstad. So we're going to disagree about everything, apparently.
You know, we can ask Judge Larson. She speaks.
I would say Jermstad, but
speaks Norwegian, so.
I didn't want to sound like this. So anyhow, I can address foreseeability. Judge Reyes, both orders only refer to negligent supervision. There's no ruling on negligent hiring with respect to foreseeability, and there are two completely different animals. With regard to supervision, I am your employee, and you're judging how I have performed on the job since or post-hire. Is there something that would suggest I'm unfit? In hiring, negligent hiring, I'm not your employee yet. You're looking into aspects of the past to indicate, is there a reasonable question about fitness? I'm simply going to point out that we tried to indicate the amount of available public information that would have been available here going back to 2015 that doesn't fall within the embrace of any prohibition. They could have done a much better job, and the only evidence in the record is experts saying that and saying that they failed.
And I do want to go to that briefly because you identify a number of, you know, so-called red flags, but, you know, at most, I think respondent conceded that at most that could be discovered would be the complaint, that a complaint was filed, but they couldn't discover the underlying reasons for the complaint. The mere fact that a complaint had been filed against a teacher, it seems like that's at most what could have been discovered. How would that, I'm having a hard time understanding how that is enough of a red flag right there.
Pardon me. Let's recognize what you're wrestling with. It's a fact issue.
Right, and I understand that. And I understand we have to view the evidence in light most favorable to you, but even if we view that evidence in light most favorable, is that enough to create a material issue of fact to overcome summary judgment? There has to be more than just woulda, coulda, shoulda. There has to be something of substance. If there was a, for instance, he's now been convicted. There is a conviction out there, and I don't.
Is, game over.
Yeah, exactly. So, or if there is an ongoing investigation and there's information that is publicly available, but here there doesn't seem to be anything to really hang your hat on.
Actually, there's quite a bit, and we tried to direct your attention to that in what I called the supplemental facts in the reply, where we're quoting the experts on how you conduct a proper...
But that's expert testimony on an issue that goes to vicarious liability, not negligent hiring. And we have to look, and it seems like that's looking with 2020 hindsight versus looking at what was known at the time and what information was out there and what could have been discovered with what is statutorily required. In other words, background check, checking with the school system to make sure he's properly licensed. What more needs to be done than that, then?
I'm going to give you the best 17-second answer I can. First of all, if I can kind of cut to the chase, as my colleague points out, Hospitality House knew the essence of the complaint from publicly available information. But the reason I was directing your attention, my time's expired. May I complete my answer,
please,
Your Honor?
Please.
The reason I was directing your attention to the experts is that they described what should be done in any responsible job search. And that includes, okay, you gave me a lead. Now I have to follow up on that lead. So that's the relevance of that information. And I will not take more of your time unless you want me to.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.